At breakfast the next morning, Santaine was brisk and brittly cheerful, though there were dark bruised smudges beneath her eyes, and the lids were puffed from weeping. "This is our last week before we must return to Cape Town," she said. "I wish we could stay here forever." "Forever is a long time, Chasseur. You have school waiting for you, and I have my duties. We will come back here, you know that." He nodded, and she went on. "I have arranged for you to spend this last week working in the washing plant and sorting rooms. You'll enjoy that, I guarantee it." She was right, as usual. The washing plant was a pleasant place. The flow of water over the whiffle boards cooled the air, and after the unremitting thunder of the mill plant, it was blessedly quiet. The atmosphere in the long brick room was like the cathedral calm of a holy place, for here the worship of mammon and adamant reached its climax. Chasseur watched with fascination as the crushings from the mill plant were carried in on the slowly moving conveyor belt. The oversized rubble had been screened off and returned for another crushing under the spinning rollers. These were the fines. They dropped from the end of the moving belt into the puddling tank, and from there were pushed by the agitating arms of the revolving sweep down the sloping boards of the whiffle table. The lighter materials floated away and were run off to the waste dump. The heavier gravels containing the diamonds were carried on through a series of similar ingenious separating devices until there remained only the concentrates, 1/1000th part of the original gravels. These were washed over the grease drums. The drums revolved slowly, each of them coated with a thick layer of heavy yellow grease. The wet gravel flowed easily over the surface, but the diamonds were dry. One of the diamond's peculiar qualities is its unwettability. Soak it, boil it as long as you wish, but it remains dry. Once the dry surface of the precious stones touched the grease, they stuck to it like insects to flypaper. The grease drums were locked behind heavy bars, and a white supervisor sat overlooking each of them, watching them constantly. Chasseur peered through the bars for the first time and saw the small miracle occur only a few inches from his nose. A wild diamond captured and tamed like some marvellous creature of the desert. He actually witnessed the moment when it flowed out of the upper bin in a wet porridge of gravel, and he saw it touch the grease and adhere precariously to the slick yellow surface, causing a tiny V-shaped disturbance to the flow, like a rock in the ebb of the tide. It moved, seeming to lose its grip in the grease for an instant, and Chasseur wanted to thrust out his hand and seize it before it was forever lost. But the gaps between the steel bars were too narrow. Then the diamond stuck fast and breasted the gentle flood of gravel, sitting up proudly, dry and transparent, like a blister on the yellow skin of a gigantic reptile. It left him with a feeling of awe, the same feelings as he had experienced when he witnessed his mare Celeste give birth to her first foal. He spent the entire morning passing from one to the other of the huge yellow drums, and then back again down the line, watching the diamonds sticking on the grease more and more thickly with each hour that passed. At noon, the washroom manager came down the line with his four white assistants, more than were necessary, other than to watch each other and forestall any opportunity for theft. With a broad-bladed spatula, they scraped the grease from the drums and collected it in the boiling pot, then meticulously spread each drum with a fresh coating of yellow grease. In the locked degreasing room at the far end of the building, the manager placed the steel pot on the spirit stove and boiled off the grease, until finally he was left with a pot half full of diamonds. And Dr. Twentyman Jones was there to weigh each stone separately and record it in the leather-bound recovery book. "Of course, you will notice, Master Chasseur, that none of these stones is smaller than half a carat." "Yes, sir." Chasseur had not thought of that. "What happened to the smaller ones?" The grease table is not infallible. Indeed, the stones must have a certain minimum weight to get them to adhere. The others, even a few large valuable stones, pass across the table. He led Chasser back to the washroom and showed him the trough of wet gravel that had survived the journey over the drums. "We drain all the water and reuse it. Out here, water is precious stuff, as you know. Then all the gravel has to be hand-picked." As he spoke, two men emerged from the door at the end of the room, and each scooped a bucket of gravel from the trough. Chasser and Twentyman Jones followed them back through the doorway into a long, narrow room, well lit with glass skylights and high windows. A single long table ran the length of the room, its top clad in a polished metal sheet. On each side of the table sat rows of women. They looked up as the two men entered, and Chasser recognized the wives and daughters of many of the white workers as well as those of the black boss boys. The white women sat together nearest the door, and, with a decent and proper distance between them, the black women sat separated at the far end of the room. The bucket boys dumped the damp gravel onto the metal table, and the women transferred their attention back to it. Each had a pair of forceps in one hand and a flat wooden scoop in the other. They drew a little of the gravel towards them, spread it with the scoop, and then picked over it swiftly. "It's a job at which the women excel," Twentyman Jones explained as they passed down the line, watching over the stooped shoulders of the women. "They have the patience and the sharp eyes and the dexterity that men lack." Chasser saw that they were picking out tiny opaque stones, some as small as sugar grains, others the size of small green peas, from the duller mass of gravel. "Those are our bread and butter stones," Twentyman Jones remarked. "They are used in industry. The jewellery-grade stones that you saw in the grease room are the strawberry jam and the cream." When the mine hooter signalled the end of the day shift, Chasser rode down with Twentyman Jones in the front seat of his Ford from the washing gear to the office block. On his lap he carried the small locked steel box in which was the day's recovery. Santaine met them on the veranda of the administration building and led them into her office. "Well, did you find it interesting?" she asked, and smiled at Chasser's hearty response. "It was fascinating, Mater, and we got one real beauty, 36 carats. It's a jolly great monster of a diamond." He set the box on her desk, and when Twentyman Jones unlocked it, he showed her the diamond as proudly as if he had mined it with his own hands. "It's big," Santaine agreed, "but the colour isn't particularly good. There, hold it to the light. See, it's as brown as whiskey and soda. And even with a naked eye, you can see the inclusions and flaws, those little black specks inside the stone, and that tear through the middle." Chasser looked crestfallen that his stone was so denigrated, and she laughed and turned to Twentyman Jones. "Let's show him some really good diamonds. Will you open the vault, please, Dr. Twentyman Jones?" Twentyman Jones pulled out the bunch of keys from the fob pocket of his waistcoat and led Chasser down the passage to the steel grill door at the end. He opened it with his key and relocked it behind them before they went down the stairs to the underground vault. Even from Chasser, he screened the lock with his body as he tumbled the combination, and then used a second key before the thick green chub steel door swung ponderously aside and they went into the strong room. "The industrial-grade stones are kept in these canisters." He touched them as he passed. "But we keep the high-grade stuff separately." He unlocked the smaller steel door set in the rear wall of the vault and selected five numbered brown paper packages from the crowded shelf. "These are our best stones. He handed them to Shasser as a mark of his trust, and then they went back again, opening and relocking each door as they passed through. Santaine was waiting for them in her office, and when Shasser placed the packages in front of her, she opened the first and gently spread the contents on her blotter. "Golly gee!" Shasser goggled at the array of large stones glittering with a soapy sheen. "They are ginormous!" "Let's ask Dr. Twentyman Jones to give us a dissertation," Santaine suggested, and hiding his gratification behind a somber countenance, he picked up one of the gemstones. "Well, Master Shasser, here is a diamond in its natural crystalline formation, the octahedron of eight faces. Count them. Here is another in a more complicated crystalline form, the dodecahedron of 12 faces, while these others are massive and uncrystallized. See how rounded and amorphous they are. Diamonds come in many guises." He laid each in Shasser's open palm, and not even his prim, monotonous recital could dull the fascination of this shining treasure. "The diamond has a perfect cleavage, or as we call it, grain, and can be split in all four directions, parallel to the octahedral crystal planes. That's how the cutters cleave a stone before polishing," Santaine cut in. "During your next holidays, I will take you to Amsterdam so you can see it done." "This rather greasy sheen will disappear when the stones are cut and polished." Twentyman Jones took over again, resenting her intrusion. "Then all their fire will be revealed as their very high refractive power captures the light within and dispersive powers separate it into the spectral colours." "How much does this one weigh?" asked Shasser. 48 carats, Santaine consulted the recovery book. "But remember, it may lose more than half its weight when it is cut and polished." "Then how much will it be worth?" asked Shasser. Santaine glanced at Twentyman Jones. "A great deal of money, Master Shasser." Like the true lover of any beautiful object, gem or painting, horse or statue, he disliked placing a monetary value upon it. So he hedged and returned to his lecture. "Now I want you to compare the colours of these stones." Darkness fell outside the windows, but Santaine switched on the lights and they huddled over the small pile of stones for another hour, meeting question with answer and talking quietly and intently, until at last Twentyman Jones swept the stones back into their packages and stood up. "Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God," he quoted unexpectedly. "Every precious stone was thy covering, the sardius, topaz, and diamond. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire." He stopped and looked self-conscious. "Forgive me, I don't know what got into me." "Ezekiel?" Santaine asked, smiling fondly at him. "Chapter 28, verses 13 and 14. He nodded, trying not to show how impressed he was by her knowledge. "I'll put these away now." "Dr. Twentyman Jones," Shasser stopped him, "you didn't answer my question. How much are these stones worth?" "Are you referring to the entire package?" He looked uncomfortable. "Including the industrials and bought still in the strong room?" "Yes, sir. How much, sir?" "Well, if De Beers accepts them at the same prices as our last package, they will fetch considerably in excess of £1,000,000, he replied sadly. £1,000,000, Shasser repeated. But Santen saw in his expression that such a figure was incomprehensible to him, like the astronomical distances between stars that must be expressed in light years. He will learn, she thought. I will teach him. Remember, Chasseur, that is not all profit, she said. From that sum we will have to pay all the expenses of the mine over the past months before we can figure a profit. And even from that we have to give the tax collectors their pound of bleeding flesh. She stood up behind the desk and then held out her hand to prevent Twentyman Jones leaving the room, as an idea struck her. As you know, Chasseur and I are going into Windhoek this coming Friday. Chasseur has to return to school at the end of next week. I will take the diamonds into the bank with me in the Daimler. Mrs. Courtney! Twentyman Jones was horrified. I couldn't allow that. £1 million worth? Good Lord alive! It would be criminally irresponsible of me to agree. He broke off as he saw her expression alter. Her mouth settled into that familiar, stubborn shape, and the lights of battle glinted in her eyes. He knew her so well, like his own daughter, and loved her as much. He realized that he had made the grievous error of challenging and forbidding her. He knew what her reaction must be, and he sought desperately to head her off. I was only thinking of you, Mrs. Courtney. £1 million of diamonds would attract every scavenger and predator, every robber and footpad for 1,000 miles around. It was not my intention to bruit it abroad. I will not broadcast it 1,000 miles around, she said coldly. The insurance! Inspiration came to him at last. The insurance will not cover losses if the package is not sent in by armed convoy. Can you truly afford to take that chance? A loss of £1 million of revenue against a few days saved? He had hit upon the one argument that might stop her. He saw her thinking about it carefully. A chance of losing £1 million against a minimal loss of face. And he sighed silently with relief when she shrugged. Oh, very well then, Dr. Twentyman Jones, have it your own way. Lothar had carved the road to Harney Mine through the desert with his own hands, and sprinkled every mile of it with the sweat of his brow. But that had been 12 years before, and now his memory of it had grown hazy. Still, he remembered half a dozen points along the road which might serve his purpose. From the stage camp where he had intercepted Gerhard Fori's convoy, they followed the rutted tracks south and west in the direction of Windhoek, travelling at night to save them from discovery by unexpected traffic on the road. On the second morning, just as the sun was rising, Lothar reached one of the points he remembered and found it ideal. Here the road ran parallel to the deep rocky bed of a dry river before looping down through the deep cutting that Lothar had excavated to cross the river bed and climb out the far side through another cutting. He dismounted and walked out along the edge of the high bank to study it carefully. They could trap the diamond truck in the gut of the cutting and block it with rocks rolled down from the top of the bank. There was certain to be water under the sand in the riverbed for the horses while they waited for the truck to show up. They would need to keep in condition for the long, hard journey ahead. The riverbed would hide them. Then again, this was the remotest stretch of the road. It would take days for the police officers to be alerted and then to reach the ambush spot. He could certainly expect to establish an early and convincing lead, even if they chose the risky alternative of following him into the hard, unrelenting wilderness across which he would retreat. "This is where we will do it," he told Svart Hendrik. They set up their primitive camp in the sheer bank of the riverbed, at the point where the telegraph line took the shortcut across the loop in the road. The copper wires were strung over the riverbed from a pole on the near bank that was out of sight of the road. Lothar climbed the pole and clipped on his taps to the main telegraph line, then led his wires down the pole, tacking them to the timber to avoid casual discovery, and then to his listening post in the dugout that Svart Hendrik had burrowed into the bank of the river. The waiting was monotonous, and Lothar chafed at being tied to the earphones of the telegraph tap, but he could not afford to miss the vital message when it was flashed from the Harney mine, the message which would give him the exact departure time of the diamond truck. So, during the dreary, hot hours of daylight, he had to listen to all the mundane traffic of the mine's daily business. And the distant operator's skills on the keyboard were such that they taxed his ability to follow and translate the rapid fire of dots and dashes that echoed in his earphones. He scribbled them into his notebook and afterwards translated the groups and jotted in the words between the lines. This was a private telegraph line, and therefore no effort had been made to encode the transmission. The traffic was in clear. During the day, he was alone in the dugout. Svart Hendrik took Manfred and the horses out in the desert, ostensibly to hunt, but really to school and harden both the boy and the animals for the journey that lay ahead, and to keep them out of sight of any traffic on the road. For Lothar, the long, monotonous days were full of doubts and foreboding. There was so much that could go wrong, so many details that had to mesh perfectly to ensure success. There were weak links, and Gerhard Fourie was the weakest of these. The whole plan hinged on the man, and he was a coward, a man easily distracted and discouraged. Waiting is always the worst time, Lothar thought, and he remembered the fears that had assailed him on the eve of other battles and desperate endeavours. If you could just do it and have done with it, instead of having to sit out these dragging days. Suddenly the buzz of the call sign echoed in his earphones, and he reached quickly for his notebook. The operator at the Harney mine began to transmit, and Lothar's pencil danced across the pages as he kept up with him. There was a curt, double tap of acknowledgement from the Windhoek station as the message ended, and Lothar let the earphones drop around his neck as he translated the groups. For Pettifogger, prepare Juno's private coach for inclusion in the Sunday night express mail train to Cape Town. Stop. Juno arriving your end, noon Sunday. Ends, Vant. Pettifogger was Abraham Abrahams. Santaine must have selected that code name when she was annoyed with him, while Vant was a pun on Twentyman Jones's name. The French connotation suggested Santaine's influence again. But Lothar wondered who had selected Juno as Santaine Courtney's code name, and grimaced at how appropriate it was. So, Santaine was leaving for Cape Town in her private coach. Somehow he felt guilty relief that she would not be close at hand when it happened, as though distance might lessen the shock for her. To reach Windhoek comfortably by noon on Sunday, Santaine must leave the Harney mine early on Friday, he calculated quickly. That would bring her to the cutting here on the riverbank on Saturday afternoon. Then he deducted a few hours from his estimate. She drove that Daimler like a demon. He sat in the hot, stuffy little dugout, and suddenly he felt an overwhelming desire to see her again, to have just a glimpse of her as she passed. "We can use it as a rehearsal for the diamond truck," he justified himself. The Daimler came out of the shimmering distances, like one of the whirling dust devils of the hot desert moons. Lothar saw the dust column from 10 miles or more and signalled Manfred and Svort Hendrik into their positions at the top of the cutting. They had dug shallow trenches at the key points, scattering the disturbed earth and letting the dry breeze smooth and blend it with the surroundings. Then they had screened the positions with branches of thorn scrub until Lothar was satisfied that they were undetectable from further than a few paces. The rocks with which they would block both ends of the cutting had been gathered laboriously from the river bed and poised on the edge of the bank. Lothar had taken great care to make them seem natural, and yet a single slash with a knife across the rope that held the prop under the rock pile would send them tumbling down onto the narrow track at the bottom of the cutting. This was a rehearsal, so none of them were wearing masks. Lothar made one last hard scrutiny of the arrangements and then turned back to watch the swiftly approaching column of dust. It was already close enough for him to make out the tiny shape of the vehicle beneath it and hear the faint beat of its engine. "She shouldn't drive like that," he thought angrily. "She'll kill herself." He broke off and shook his head ruefully. "I'm acting like a doting husband," he realized. "Let her break her damned neck if that's what she wants." Yet the idea of her death gave him a painful pang, and he crossed his fingers to turn the chance away. Then he crouched down in his trench and watched her through the screen of thorn brambles and branches. The stately vehicle rocked and bounced over the tracks as it swung onto the loop of the road. The engine beat strengthened as Santain changed down and then accelerated out of the turn, using power to pull out of the incipient skid as the flowery dust clutched at the front wheels. "It was done with a Lan," he thought grudgingly, as she hit the gears again and bore down on the head of the cutting at speed. "Merciful God, is she going to take it at full bore?" he wondered. But at the last moment, she cut the throttle and used the gearbox and the drag of the clinging dust to pull up at the top end of the cutting. As she opened the door and stepped out onto the running board with dust billowing around her, she was only 20 paces from where he lay, and he felt his heart banging against the earth. "Can she still do this to me?" he wondered at himself. "I should hate her. She had cheated and humiliated me, and she has spurned my son and denied him a mother's love. And yet, he would not let the words form, and he tried deliberately to harden himself against her. "She's not beautiful," he told himself as he studied her face. But she was much more. She was vital and vibrant, and there was an aura about her. Juno, he recalled the code name, the goddess. Powerful and dangerous, mercurial and unpredictable, but endlessly fascinating and infinitely desirable. She looked directly towards him for a moment, and he felt the strength and resolve flow out of him at the touch of those dark eyes. But she had not seen him, and she turned away. "We will walk down, Sherry," she called to the young man who stepped out of the opposite side of the Daimler, "to see if the crossing is safe." Chassa seemed to have grown inches in the short time since Lothar had last seen him. They left the vehicle and went side by side down the track below where Lothar lay. Manfred was in his trench at the bottom end of the cutting. He also watched the pair come down the track. The woman meant nothing to him. She was his mother, but he did not know that, and there was no instinctive response within him. She had never given him suck or even held him in her arms. She was a stranger, and he glanced at her without any emotion. then turned all his attention to the youth at her side. Shasser's good looks offended him. "He's as pretty as a girl," he thought, trying to scorn him. But he saw the new breadth to his rival's shoulders and fine muscle in his brown arms, where he had rolled his sleeves high. "I would like another bout with you, my friend." The almost forgotten sting and humiliation of Shasser's left fist hurt again like a fresh wound, and he touched his own face with his fingertips, scowling at the memory. "Next time, I won't let you do your little dance." And he thought about how hard it had been to touch that pretty face, the way it had swayed and dipped just beyond his reach, and he felt the frustration anew. The couple reached the foot of the cutting below where Manfred lay, and stood talking quietly for a while. Then Shasser trudged out into the wide river bed. The roadway through the sand had been corduroyed with branches of acacia, but the wheels of heavy trucks had broken them up. Shasser rearranged them, stamping the jagged ends into the sand. While he worked, Santaine turned back to the Daimler. There was a canvas water bag hanging on the bracket of the spare wheel, and she unhooked it, raised it to her lips, and took a mouthful. She gargled softly, and then spat it into the dust. Then she slipped off the long white dust jacket that protected her clothing and unbuttoned her blouse. She soaked the yellow scarf and wiped the damp cloth down her throat and over her bosom, gasping with pleasure at the coolness on her skin. Lothar wanted to turn his head away, but he could not. Instead, he stared at her. She wore nothing under the pale blue cotton blouse. The skin of her bosom was untouched by the sun, pale, smooth, and pearly as fine bone china. Her breasts were small, without any puckering and sagging, the tips pointed and still clear rose-coloured as those of a girl, not of a woman who had borne two sons. They bounced elastically as she drew the wet scarf over them, and she looked down at them as she bathed the gleam of perspiration from them. Lothar moaned softly in his throat at the need of her that rose freshly and strongly from deep within him. "All set, mater," Shasser called as he started back up the track, and quickly Santaine rebuttoned the front of her blouse. "We've wasted enough time," she agreed, and slipped back behind the wheel of the Daimler. As Shasser slammed his door, she gunned the big motor down the track, kicking up sand and splinters of acacia in a spray from the back wheels as she crossed the riverbed and flew up the far bank. The rumble of the engine dwindled into the desert silence, and Lothar found he was trembling. None of them moved for many minutes. It was Svart Hendrik who rose to his feet first. He opened his mouth to speak and then saw the expression on Lothar's face and remained silent. He scrambled down the bank and set off back towards the camp. Lothar climbed down to the spot where the Daimler had stopped. He stood, looking down at the damp earth where she had spat that mouthful of water. Her footprints were narrow and neat in the dust, and he felt a strong urge to scoop and touch them. But suddenly Manfred spoke close behind him. "He is a boxer," he said, and it took Lothar a moment to realize that he was talking about Shasser. "He looks a real sissy, but he can fight. You can't hit him." He put up his fists and shadow-boxed, shuffling and dancing in the dust, imitating Shasser. "Let's get back to the camp out of sight," Lothar said, and Manfred dropped his guard and thrust his hands into his pockets. Neither of them spoke again until they reached the dugout. "Can you box, Pa?" Manfred asked. "Can you teach me to box?" Lothar smiled and shook his head. I always found it easier to kick a man between his legs, he said, and then hit him with a bottle or a gun butt. I would like to learn to box, Manfred said. Some day I will learn. Perhaps the idea had been germinating there all along, but suddenly it was a firm declaration. His father smiled indulgently and clapped him on the shoulder. Get out the flour bag, he said, and I will teach you to bake soda bread instead. Oh, Abe, you know how much I detest these soirees, Santaine exclaimed irritably. Crowded rooms filled with tobacco smoke, exchanging inanities with strangers. This man could be very valuable to know, Santaine. I will go further than that. He could be the most valuable friend you'll ever make in this territory. Santaine pulled a face. Abe was right, of course. The administrator was, in fact, the governor of the territory, with wide executive powers. He was appointed by the government of the Union of South Africa under the powers of mandate conferred on it by the Treaty of Versailles.